Aislinn Antrim with Pharmacy Times, and you're listening to Pharmacy Focus Oncology Edition, where we break down the latest news in the oncology pharmacy space. This month, we spoke with Cassia Griswold, a clinical oncology pharmacist and PGY2 Oncology Residency Program Director at Mayo Clinic, Arizona, for an update on the prostate cancer treatment space. So to kind of get started, can you give us an overview of the prostate cancer space and kind of how it's developed in the last few years?
Yes, of course. So the basis of prostate cancer treatment is really androgen deprivation therapy, or ADT for short. And this is essentially reducing testosterone levels to really very low, less than 50 nanograms per deciliter. And this is done either by means of orchiectomy or chemical castration with agents like gonadotropin-releasing hormone agonists or antagonists. Testosterone acts like a growth signal for prostate cells. And so by removing this, we can significantly reduce or inhibit growth of the cancer cells. So the role of ADT really hasn't changed. That's still sort of the cornerstone of treatment. However, the additional agents we have in our arsenal and kind of when we use them is what has really changed drastically. I would say the most significant change over the last 5 years or so is the move of therapeutic agents to earlier on in the disease course. So we have drugs like abiraterone or enzalutamide that were previously developed in the metastatic castrate refractory setting, which are now well studied in the metastatic castration sensitive or even high risk locally advanced, so really non-metastatic disease. We're also seeing a variety of studies evaluating combination therapy in prostate cancer. So, for example, Pluvicto plus antiandrogens or PARP inhibitors plus antiandrogens. And then the combination of chemotherapy plus antiandrogens is already actually approved and on guideline as well for a subset of patients. And I guess I should comment too, there's a lot of different terminology in prostate cancer. And so just to be kind of clear for the rest of our discussion, generally when I'm talking about the novel hormonal therapies, things like abiraterone, darolutamide, enzalutamide, for the sake of simplicity and clarity, I just kind of refer to these as antiandrogens, and I'll try to continue to do so as we continue on our discussion.
Wonderful. Perfect. How is the use of PARP inhibitors changing treatment for prostate cancer?
So prostate cancer does benefit from having longer survival in the metastatic setting than a lot of other solid tumors. However, we still really only have a handful of treatment options in that space. And so PARP inhibitors really provide us a treatment option with a very different mechanism from other therapies in this space. However, as of right now, patients must have pathogenic mutations or deficiencies in BRCA1 or BRCA2 or other homologous recombination repair genes like ATM, BRIP, PALB2, et cetera, to be candidates for PARP inhibitor therapy.
Wonderful. You mentioned that this is a very kind of novel mechanism compared to others. Can you discuss the primary mechanism for PARP inhibitors in prostate cancer?
Sure. Yeah. So BRCA1 and 2 genes encode for proteins that are critical for homologous recombination DNA repair. And cancer cells with deletions or deleterious mutations in BRCA1 and 2 aren't able to properly repair double-stranded DNA breaks, and they must rely on really their alternate pathway for repairing single-strand breaks. So this pathway is regulated by polyadenosine diphosphate polymerase, or PARP for short. And so inhibition of PARP with PARP inhibitors actually results in cancer cell death due to overaccumulation of this irreparable DNA damage.
Very interesting. How are PARP inhibitors typically sequenced, and kind of how do they fit into the larger treatment pattern for PARP or for prostate cancer?
Yes, I know a lot of P words that we're using here. So PARP inhibitors, really currently NCCN guidelines endorse the use of PARP inhibitors as monotherapy for metastatic castration resistant prostate cancer. This is after treatment with antiandrogen therapy, so generally second line or beyond. In May of this year, the FDA actually approved the PARP inhibitor olaparib in combination with abiraterone as first line treatment for BRCA mutated metastatic castration resistant prostate cancer and kind of the first line therapy. And then actually the combination of niraparib plus abiraterone, as well as talazoparib plus enzalutamide, are also currently under review by the FDA for this space. So I do expect that all three combinations will eventually be added to the guidelines with future revisions. And then as far as kind of use, the guidelines do recommend testing for BRCA or homologous recombination repair mutations at the time of diagnosis of metastatic disease. And so for the previous indication or the kind of the current on guideline indications for PARP inhibitors in the second line and later, this could be done really efficiently because you would test the patient when they presented with metastatic disease, and then you would have the results of the genetic testing at the time of disease progression to guide selection of the next line therapy option. So germline, but actually also somatic BRCA mutations are present pretty early on in pathogenesis for prostate cancer. These mutations are not really acquired from treatment. So we're able to do that kind of early testing. But I think one of the challenges is with use of these agents now in these kind of first line combinations is going to be turnaround time for testing.
Wonderful. What are the commonly used PARP inhibitors for this indication, and are there any in the pipeline?
Sure. So olaparib is currently approved for patients with germline or somatic homologous recombination repair gene mutations, although the majority of the benefit in the PROfound trial was seen in the BRCA1, BRCA2, and then ATM mutation populations. So even though this approval extends to other mutations, many providers will still limit use to this kind of core group of mutations. And then the FDA approval for olaparib in combination with abiraterone, kind of interestingly, is only for patients with BRCA1 and BRCA2 mutations. And then our another agent, which we don't discuss as we haven't discussed really as much or haven't mentioned yet, but is rucaparib. And this is approved for patients, same thing with germline or somatic BRCA1 and 2 mutations only. And this is on the basis of the TRITON2 study, which essentially showed the best response and survival outcomes in that specific population. And then, oh, a pipeline. So as far as treatments in the pipeline, I have discussed a couple of the other combinations that are sort of under FDA review right now. There are several other PARP-based treatments in the pipeline. So this includes PARP inhibitors used in other disease states like niraparib or talazoparib that are now being studied in prostate cancer. They're also being looked at in more localized disease, either prior to surgery or concomitantly with radiation. But I think the biggest area of kind of current and ongoing research is in combination with anti-androgen therapy.
Wonderful. At ASCO just a couple weeks ago, investigators announced results from the TALAPRO-2 study, which combined the PARP inhibitor talazoparib with enzalutamide. So, can you discuss the goals of this trial and why this combination could be efficacious?
Sure. So TALAPRO-2 was a phase 3 multicenter randomized placebo-controlled trial, and it was looking at the antiandrogen enzalutamide at standard dosing of 160 milligrams daily with or without the PARP inhibitor talazoparib, and that was dosed at 0.5 milligrams daily, which is a little bit different dosing than we use in like the breast and other populations. And this was specifically for first-line treatment of metastatic castrate-resistant prostate cancer. So the study was actually completed in patients with and without homologous recombination repair mutations. The first cohort one included was kind of all comers, and then their cohort two, the patient specifically had to have those HRR mutations or deletions. And then really the rationale for this study is based on there's preclinical data or preclinical research suggesting synergy between the PARP inhibitors and the anti-androgen therapies. PARP supports androgen function, and really both of those have a role in regulation of DNA transcription. And so the kind of idea is that inhibition of PARP should increase the sensitivity of the cancer cells to the anti-androgen-directed therapies.
Very interesting. What did the study show with regard to progression-free survival, and how significant is this finding?
Yeah, there were a variety of analyses done with the TALAPRO-2 data. I would say the first is in the all-comers population, in which really the progression-free survival, median progression-free survival was not reached, and that was compared to a progression-free survival of 21.9 months in the group that was treated with just enzalutamide alone. The hazard ratio for this was 0.63, which is quite respectable. And then we look at the outcomes in in specifically the homologous recombination repair deficient population, where there's a median progression-free survival of 27.9 months with the combination of talazoparib and enzalutamide versus 16.4 months with enzalutamide alone. So this is essentially an absolute increase in about 11 months in progression-free survival time. And there was a hazard ratio of 0.46, which essentially relates to a 54% reduction in risk of a progression event. And when we look at, they did a bunch of subgroup analyses to this data as well. And really, the progression-free survival benefit favors the combination of talazoparib plus enzalutamide across all of the subgroups, although really the largest benefit was seen in the roughly 8% of patients on study with BRCA1 and 2 alterations. And actually, for this subset, it was a small number of patients relatively, but there's a hazard ratio of 0.23, which is quite impressive. And then I would say a couple of, it's not really progression-free survival, but a couple of other notable outcomes. There was an objective response rate of 62% with the combination versus 44% with enzalutamide alone. And this kind of also included a 38% complete response rate. So really, as a whole, all of these results are from this trial are very positive.
Have you listened to other podcasts from Pharmacy Focus? We have podcasts for all interests, from students to psychedelics. In the latest episode of Pharmacy Focus, we spoke with an expert about the recent FDA approval of lecanemab and what it means for those who have Alzheimer's disease. Listen now wherever you get your podcasts. How could these findings change the treatment approaches for prostate cancer?
Yeah, I think we can't discuss the findings of TALAPRO2 in isolation. I think to really understand the potential impact, we have to also consider the results of some of the other phase three studies in this space, so that including PROPEL and MAGNITUDE. And really across these studies, the combination of PARP inhibitor plus antiandrogen in the treatment of metastatic castration-resistant prostate cancer results in a longer time until cancer progression, as well as more patients with treatment response on subsequent imaging. I do also think it's important to note that there hasn't been long enough follow-up for any of these trials at this point to have accurate ideas or numbers regarding overall survival outcomes. And then there's another, I would say, important implication of these studies is the potential to expand the population that can receive a PARP inhibitor. So for the last few years, the use of PARP inhibitors in this space has really been limited to those with BRCA or homologous recombination repair mutations, which is only about 10 to 20% of the patient population. As I mentioned earlier, olaparib's recent FDA approval in combination with abiraterone is still sort of limited to that patient population. However, with the results of TALAPRO2, talazoparib and enzalutamide may or may not open this use up the com open up the use of this combination to potentially a broader all-comer population. We'll have to kind of wait and see on that. And then I think too, what's interesting when you look across these three trials, it kind of highlights some of the key differences. So the degree of response in the homologous recombination repair deficient versus the kind of all-comer population. So we see a more significant response in the all-comer population, I would argue, with talazoparib and enzalutamide, which sort of reinforces the idea that's been kind of discussed for some time that really not all PARP inhibitors are created equal. And so I would say it's likely with, some more time and additional studies, it'll become a little more apparent which PARP inhibitor is and which combination is going to be the most efficacious for our patients. And I guess I would say my last comment about this, or kind of in response to your question, is I think more the practical challenge of applying this data. So, the current PARP inhibitor data that we've been discussing is really in a patient population that doesn't necessarily reflect the majority of patients that at least we see in our clinic here anymore. Most patients with newly metastatic castration-sensitive disease will be treated with androgen deprivation therapy and an anti-androgen up front. And so I think most of the providers I work with would not really consider using a combination PARP inhibitor plus antiandrogen upon disease progression, just because there are a lot of previous studies demonstrating high rates of cross-resistance and low response rates to abiraterone after enzalutamide and vice versa. And when we look at like TALAPRO-2, only 6% of the patients included on that study had received a previous treatment with an antiandrogen like abiraterone. As of now, there's not great evidence that the addition of a PARP inhibitor kind of counteracts the potential cross-resistance of antiandrogen after previous antiandrogen, sort of limiting the efficacy, I think, of this data in patients that have already received more than just androgen deprivation therapy treatment. There are trials ongoing, though, in the metastatic castration-sensitive prostate cancer space, so kind of that upfront, more upfront setting with niraparib and abiraterone, and that's the Amplitude trial, and then TALAPRO-2, so or TALAPRO-3, excuse me, talazoparib and enzalutamide is also being studied in that space. So I think if those are positive, that may also do more to kind of increase the volume of patients receiving these PARP antiandrogen combinations.
Very interesting. What are the common adverse events or challenges with PARP inhibitors, and how are pharmacists involved in their management?
Sure. Yeah. The most common side effects include cytopenias, nausea and vomiting, diarrhea, fatigue. There is some variation between agents. So, for example, thrombocytopenia is much more profound with niraparib compared to olaparib. Talazoparib seems to fall somewhere kind of in the middle. GI side effects like diarrhea and nausea, those are less frequent with talazoparib compared to olaparib, for example. It's also important to take into account that the tolerability is impacted by the other treatment, so the antiandrogen it's being paired with. For example, enzalutamide is associated with more CNS effects, so I would expect a higher incidence of fatigue, for example, with those combinations compared to abiraterone-based combinations. One thing that is sort of interesting, though, is when they developed a lot of these studies, is that most of the doses for the PARP inhibitors is lower than what it would be when they're utilized as monotherapy, which really I think speaks to the necessity of kind of dose attenuation or utilizing the lower doses for that long-term tolerability in this patient population. And then I guess to the second part of your question, really what pharmacists can do, I think we can have a huge impact on side effect management, which ultimately translates to a patient's ability to stay on therapy. This often begins before the patient even starts the treatment. So comprehensive education on, correct administration, proper use of the supportive care medications, as well as just review of the prescription itself. Many of the PARP inhibitors require dose reductions for a creatinine clearance of less than 60 mL per minute, which is a much different threshold than we have for a lot of our other cancer therapeutics, and this often gets missed during prescribing. And then once patients actually start therapy, I think how pharmacists can be involved, are a lot of opportunities there as well, depending a little bit on your practice site. So anything from ensuring, the appropriate lab monitoring that's needed, as well as interpretation of those lab results, ordering of additional supportive care medications, facilitating dose reductions, and then again, additional education about supportive care. Those are certainly all things in which we can really be an asset.
Absolutely. With kind of all of these different moving pieces in mind, what monitoring is necessary for patients undergoing treatment with PARP inhibitors?
Yeah, the laboratory monitoring I think is fairly straightforward. CBC is really the most important aspect of the laboratory monitoring, although the frequency does vary a little bit by the PARP inhibitor. So niraparib, the recommendations currently are to test for a CBC weekly for the first 2 months, whereas olaparib, rucaparib, talazoparib, generally you can evaluate CBC every 4 weeks or so. And then renal function should be assessed periodically. And if they're having a lot of GI losses from side effects like diarrhea or nausea, then certainly you'd want additional aspects of a metabolic panel, electrolytes, things like that. And as far as more of the clinical monitoring side for toxicities, really that should be completed at regular intervals as well. So, in my opinion, ideally the pharmacist or the patient would have contact with either a pharmacist, advanced practice provider, or a physician every 2 weeks for the first 2 to 3 months, and then monthly thereafter. I know in practice, if a patient's stable after the first handful of months, sometimes we'll decrease the intervals even beyond monthly. But especially when as they're adjusting to therapy, I think that frequency of follow-up is very important.
Absolutely. Financial toxicity is a major issue throughout really all of oncology. But what does this issue look like in prostate cancer and with PARP inhibitors?
In prostate cancer treatment right now, the majority of new therapies are orally administered agents. So, anecdotally, this is a really big patient satisfier. Most patients prefer these targeted or hormonal therapies over your traditional cytotoxic treatments. They also create an opportunity for decreased visits to the cancer center, greater flexibility for the patient to travel, engage in hobbies, et cetera. But I think one of the biggest challenges we face in practice with oral therapies is the financial toxicity to the patient. And PARP inhibitors are really no exception to that. Frustratingly, we've actually had quite a few patients that couldn't start a prescribed therapy due to the cost of the medication.
Yeah, that's a big challenge. How can pharmacists help patients manage financial concerns, and what resources are there?
Yeah, so I'd say as long as the oral agent is being prescribed for an on-label or on-guideline use, it should be covered by most prescription insurance plans. However, these drugs do have a really high associated cost with them, and unfortunately, some of the responsibility for that cost does get shared with the patient. For commercially insured patients, the solution can be a little more straightforward. Most oral therapies for prostate cancer right now are still under patent, and so they have associated copay cards or other manufacturer assistance programs that will greatly reduce the copay or the cost to the patient. Unfortunately, patients with Medicare prescription drug coverage don't qualify for most of these programs. And so that means that those patients that are, on fixed incomes either have to pay large sums of money out of pocket or apply for some of the manufacturer assistance programs that do offer free drugs to those that qualify, although there are usually income thresholds for those particular programs. There are also several cancer foundations that exist and offer funding to patients. However, they are usually assigned or kind of allocated based on disease state. And so the demand for resources really kind of usually exceeds what is available, especially within prostate cancer. So unfortunately, we don't haven't really found foundation funding, at least in our practice, to be a very reliable source of patient assistance. Fortunately, I would say over the last couple of years, we have seen the rise of several low-cost direct-to-consumer pharmacies that can supply generic cancer therapies like abiraterone, for example, at a very competitive price. And I often find that this is lower than what the patient's copay through their Medicare Part D plan would be. And so this really has provided us an additional option for either uninsured or underinsured patients.
Good. Where's the future of PARP inhibitors and prostate cancer research going?
As far as PARP inhibitors go, I think that the results from TALAPRO-2 and the other studies we've discussed have certainly, I think, earned them a role in the metastatic castration-resistant prostate cancer space. However, I do think the ongoing trials in the kind of earlier line setting, so the castration-sensitive prostate cancer space, could potentially be more impactful in terms of just expanding the role and reaching a larger number of patients across a variety of lines of treatment. And then as far as prostate cancer as a whole goes, I do expect that this trend of combining agents with different mechanisms will continue. There is a lot of appeal to finding a combination of therapies that's both tolerable and also produces a more durable response, as durability is something, especially in later lines of therapy, that we're still kind of lacking. And then I guess lastly, continued work to really, I think, better characterize and understand some of these additional mutations and markers in prostate cancer that really may create opportunities for us for rational drug development and some novel drug therapies that aren't currently in development.
Thanks for listening to Pharmacy Focus Oncology Edition. If you're interested in learning more about prostate cancer, check out pharmacytimes.com. And as always, tune into the next episode to learn more about what pharmacists need to know in the oncology space.